Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Bone Up. How are you doing, Richie?
Not bad, David. Had a nice summer holiday. Come back refreshed, ready for the new year. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness here in the UK. I had my son's wedding there just last week. We were over in Edinburgh, and not only did we have a great time at the wedding, but I got a chance to speak to a number of listeners to the podcast, would you believe, who were guests, some GPs and some medical students. And some people, Richie, would you believe, hadn't heard of the podcast, but I was able to point them in the right direction, and they couldn't wait to get away from the reception to download a few episodes, or so they told me anyway.
We're going to have to get some influencers to advertise the podcast for us.
And I made a speech in which I didn't mention osteoclasts for the first time in about 20 years as well, so that was a novelty.
I'm glad you had a good time.
Yeah, and I mean, my son does some of the graphics for our podcast, and indeed I met the brother of the musician who composed our jingle as well, by remarkable coincidence. So even though I was getting away from Bone and getting away from the podcast, it turned out to be interwoven through all aspects of my life. We had a really nice time, and yeah, it's good to be back. Looking forward to all the things between now and Christmas.
Listeners, this is the last episode in this series of Bone Up, but don't worry, we'll be back soon with series 4. And today we have a really good episode to finish the series. We're going to touch on a topic that we haven't really discussed very much in the past, and that's genetics. David, do your patients ever ask about the genetic basis of their disease, or whether or not they might be able to receive a genetic test for osteoporosis?
Yeah, it is actually quite a common question. I've said to you before, I think the single commonest question is often about nutrition or what people can eat to influence their bone health. But certainly those who I've told have quite significant osteoporosis, many of them will ask about genetic testing, or ask, you know, even if they're aware that it runs in their family, will ask if there's anything can be done to sort of put a label on that, or get a clearer idea of how it affects them or how it might affect other family members. Of course, I have to say to them that there is no one gene test for osteoporosis, and you do have to tease out a little exactly what people understand by genetic testing. Do they mean, why have they got osteoporosis? And sometimes you see patients with, you know, very low T scores without any very obvious reason for it, and they are very interested to know if there's a genetic reason. You see others who are worried about their children or their grandchildren. When I explain to them, you know, there's no single test for osteoporosis, that it is caused by dozens, if not hundreds, of different genes all working together, that can be a bit disappointing for people. I would say it's a question asked more by younger people rather than older people as well. Although there's no doubt that our understanding of how genetics influences bone health, even when you're older, is developing as well. It's not just the younger people we're interested in.
We hear a lot about genetic testing in the case of cancer and in rare diseases. People would expect there to be a test for osteoporosis as well, but I guess not everybody knows about the big polymorphisms that underlie the disease.
That's right. I try to explain it to people in terms of, for example, you have a journey to work that lasts for an hour, and how can you make that journey faster or shorter? Well, there's lots of little things along the way. You could get held up at a junction. There could be roadworks. You could you know, someone might walk out in front, and all those things just add 10 seconds or you speed up by 30 seconds. And at the end of the big long journey, that determines whether your journey's, you know, an hour and a half or an hour, 10 minutes. But there's no one big single reason. And with osteoporosis, for most people, they then understand that there's many, many genes which make a small contribution to how strong their bones are, how elastic their bones are. And it's when you put all those pluses and minuses together that you get an overall picture. And to just pick out one or two of those genes and to look at them doesn't really help. And in general, we're not in a position yet to screen hundreds and hundreds of genes and put them together for people, certainly not in a clinical day-to-day NHS setting. And I suppose the other thing that I sometimes introduce to people is the idea that at some point we may be able to look and decide which drug is best for you in with reference to your genes. And while sort of genetic testing, to put that in inverted commas, for why you have osteoporosis might be interesting, more relevantly to your treatment and your future might be genes we could look at to decide whether you would respond, you know, better to this anabolic drug or that anabolic drug, or perhaps even genes that would suggest how long you should be on a bisphosphonate or on denosumab for. And I think that's probably something that, you know, I would be interested in hearing more research about, and that patients might be interested in as well. Of course, there are gene tests for rare bone diseases, and you know, in some ways we might want to exclude some of those rare bone diseases by gene testing, but that's not something we would we would crop up in a lot of conversations.
Okay, it's time to get our guest on the show. It's our great pleasure to introduce our guest today. We have Professor Emma Duncan. Emma is Professor of Clinical Endocrinology in the Faculty of Life Sciences and Medicine at King's College London, and an Honorary Consultant in Endocrinology at Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust. Professor Duncan is Joint Director for the KHP Diabetes, Endocrinology and Obesity, which is a clinical academic partnership at King's College London, where Professor Duncan is the co-research lead. If that's not enough, Emma's also president-elect of the American Society for Bone and Mineral Research, the ASBMR. And for those of you who don't know, that is the world's leading professional society for musculoskeletal disorders. It's based in the US, but operates internationally, and it's a place where all scientists and all clinicians can go to study bone disease and bone medicine. Emma, thank you for joining us today.
We're really delighted you've made time in your busy schedule to come and speak to us. We're really looking forward to chatting to you.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for such a warm and wonderful welcome. I want to say what an honour it is for me and how much I've enjoyed listening to you on my walks with the dog in the park and at various other times listening to the podcast. It's a fantastic program.
You say all the right things, Emma. We're delighted you've made time to speak to us today. Thank you.
It's really great to hear that you're listening to the podcast. I understand this isn't the first time you've been on a podcast.
No, this is the second time, but this time I think I've got a better idea of what's going to happen. Before I left Australia, on the last time that I moved between Australia and the UK, I had written an article for the ABC Conversation called Why Do We Have Bones? In answer to a question from a five-year-old. And in response to this article, the ABC said, would I like to come and do a podcast? And perhaps I should have thought a little bit more about this, but I came in and I went to the TARDIS, which is what the recording studios are actually called at the ABC in Queensland. And it was only when I got there that I realised that this was for the under five science program called Imagine This. And so, first of all, it was a great joy to do that recording. And second of all the prep that I'd done beforehand really wasn't necessary, because the things that I was being asked about were much more about whether the hip bone connected to the knee bone and so forth and so on, which was, again, a great joy to have a conversation about. But the other thing was that the number of parents who'd listened to the podcast in the car or when they were putting their kids to bed or during bath time amazed me. I got a huge amount of feedback from the audience. So I'm not expecting the same with this, but we'll see.
I don't know about the demographics of our listeners, Emma, but, you know, they say if you can explain something to a five-year-old, then you really understand it.
Well, I'd say the firearms are also very sophisticated. Mm. I mean, the sorts of things we talked about is, you know, why do we have a skeleton? We talked about the armor aspect of the, you know, the skull being a helmet and the being able to have a rib cage to protect soft organs like hearts and lungs, but with a movable system that allows air to move in and out. But we also talked about, I mean, in one sense, that's the obvious. And we also talked about movement and having big bones moved by big muscles and little bones moved by little muscles. But we also talked about the importance of having a silo for electricity, because kids understand electricity. So talking about the movement of electrolytes and that really, you know, you need to have calcium as a silo from bones to be able to keep levels steady. They understood that. And they also understood the concept of bone marrow providing white cells to fight infection. They knew what germs were. And so being able to talk about all of these functions of bone at really quite a sophisticated level was you know, I think people often underestimate how much science children understand. And certainly I find listening to the Imagine This program, which, as I said, is targeting the under fives, I learn a great deal of science.
That's really wonderful. I find that young people always ask the most difficult questions, you know, things that you haven't really ever thought about before.
Oh, for sure. And in fact, the interviewer, when I wrote the first article about why do we have bones, they actually picked me up because I hadn't really answered the question, why do we have bones? What I'd actually answered the question was, what is the function of a skeleton? And it was only when they came back and said, well, you know, what is, you know, why do we have bones? It's actually a subtly different question to the one that I actually answered, which people often do on interviews, actually. You know, if you listen to politicians, they often give you a different answer to the question that you actually asked. Hopefully I won't do that for you guys today.
Fingers crossed. One of our aims for the podcast is to try and bring the most recent research to the public and professionals, and especially if that research is going to be helpful for treating and preventing bone disease in the future. So we'd really like to have you on today to talk about the relationship between our genome and bone fragility and whether or not genetics can cause bone fragility. For the audience at home and for many people, we think of bone fractures as an accident or a sign of aging. How can genetics play a role in making somebody's bone more fragile, even from a young age, like children?
So this really, Richie, is what I've spent most of my professional scientific life answering, which is this question, you know, is bone mass genetically determined? So to come back to make sure I'm actually answering the question that you asked, why are people fracturing at an older age and how are genetics actually relevant to that? Are genetics really important in terms of why somebody might, for example, have a fall or a trip? And we can come back to that a little bit later on if we want to. But really what sets up our ability to grow a good skeleton is what we inherit from our parents. And so we have this term in genetics called heritability, and it's how much of the spread of a trait in the population is genetically determined. And for bone, that's actually quite high. About 60 to 80% of what determines the spread of bone density in the population is determined by our genetics. And it's particularly what helps us to grow that's genetically determined. So you see heritability, how much is genetically determined, highest when you're looking at young adults, people at the age of about 20 to 30, which is when we think about achieving peak bone mass. So as we grow as children, then as we go through puberty and start sex hormones coming in, as our bones stop growing in length and start putting down mass, we achieve our peak bone mass for most people around the age of 20 to 30. And from then on down, it's slow attrition all the way. Life gets worse after that point in time, at least from the point of view of achieving your peak bone mass. And most people will lose about 1% of their bone mass per year from that point on, with an acceleration for women as they go through menopause and experience hypogonadism, and with other insults to the skeleton having an effect as well, such as, for example, men who might be on androgen ablation therapy for prostate cancer, or people who smoke, or people who have to take steroids for their health for other reasons. But leaving aside those issues, it is the determination of peak bone mass which predominantly determines what ends up happening in terms of your bone at an older age. So somebody who is fracturing and having vertebral fractures, say in their 60s, are achieving that, are having those fractures because of how they have grown their skeleton as a younger person, and then having subsequently had gradual losses since, with some environmental issues put on that. And in terms of what contributes to those genetics that actually determine how we grow our skeleton, this is true. Sometimes we think about genetics in terms of diseases as being disorders where we see big effects. And certainly from a bone fragility point of view, there are certain genes where carrying pathological variants can have a big effect in terms of skeletal fragility. So many people in the audience would be familiar with a disease, osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a heterogeneous group of bone disorders of really quite severe bone fragility for many individuals. And people who've got a pathological variant or a likely pathological variant in now 37 known genes for different types of osteogenesis imperfecta, that's probably 38 and probably by the time the podcast goes out 39. These people have got a single variant which explains a lot of their bone fragility. However, at the general population level, that's not the major things which determine bone fragility. At a population level, it's the cumulative effect of many, many variants, each of which have a small effect, some of which might increase bone density, some of which might decrease bone density. But the sum of those, all of these little tiny effects, sum together to give an individual their particular risk of bone fragility. For most of the population, that'll be average, but almost by definition. But you'll still have people at both ends of the tail. You'll have some people who've got high bone mass because of all of these individual variants summing together, and you'll have some people who've got low bone mass, again, because the variants they have sum together to give the lower bone mass. And of course, the people who've got pathological variants in rare genes, or in genes which cause the rare bone disorders, they too have this polygenic background as well. So the expression of how those variants with big effect, how that plays out in an individual and within their family, will depend upon their background as well. The two are not mutually exclusive.
Genetic testing is becoming more common. It's more accessible. People can go online now and buy all sorts of genetic tests for better or worse. And people come to my osteoporosis clinic sometimes and say, can I get a genetic test for osteoporosis? And, you know, often I do a bit of chatting around that and explain why it's not maybe just as simple as they think. But what sort of genetic tests perhaps could I be doing for standard osteoporosis? Or perhaps in the next 5 to 10 years, what sort of genetic tests do you think might be useful if we're thinking of trying to personalize medicine for the patient in front of us?
I'm going to answer your question, David, by splitting it into a couple of components. Because there's what can I do now in my general bone clinic? There's what can I do when I've got somebody who's got a slightly unusual presentation? There's what do I think is going to come in the very near future in terms of genetic technologies playing into normal clinical practice? And there's what could those genetic technologies actually achieve in terms of personalizing things? To come to the first bit in terms of, you know, what's available now, one of the great strengths of practicing in the NHS in England at the moment is the excellent access to genetic services, which are really quite marked compared to many of the rest of the world. We have fantastic resources. I know that the other devolved countries of Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland have slightly separate access. Nonetheless, this still really is amazing at a world-class level to have these genetic resources to help clinical management. The capacity to be able to get testing through Genomics England's provision of genetic services and through the different laboratories that look after this is just amazing. We are really blessed by being able to do this now. So compared to many countries around the world, people in England have extraordinary capacity to be able to access genetic testing for when people think that they might have a rare monogenic disorder. So to come to your next question, David, really it's, well, how many people in my clinics actually have a rare monogenic disorder when they look like they've got common or garden osteoporosis? And this is a question that we actually answered looking at the Anglo-Australasian Osteoporosis Genetics Consortium. And here what we did was we sequenced 500 women who looked like they had otherwise unremarkable osteoporosis, a Z-score, which is a measure of where people are relative to the average bone density, between minus 1.5 and minus 4. So they were low, but they weren't super low compared to the general population. And in that cohort, and these were women aged between 55 to 80, where people might think, well, you know, whatever, they've gone through menopause. It's not surprising that their bone density might be a little bit on the low side. What we actually found was that 4% of these people in this cohort had a variant in one of the known dominant osteogenesis imperfecta genes. Where that variant had previously been reported for osteogenesis imperfecta, or where it affected the same base where it had been reported previously, or it affected the same amino acid, or where it affected the glycine, which for various reasons is particularly common for people who've got OI. So 4% of the people who looked like they had common or garden OP actually had a form first of osteogenesis imperfecta in an otherwise, that minus 1.5 as a Z-score is, as I said, it's on the lower side. So to come back to, you know, where you should be looking, I mean, I think that very rapidly we're going to see the evolution of genetic technologies being built into our system within the next 5 to 10 years, an awful lot of information is going to become available to help clinicians. Some of that will be looking for pathogenic variants, and we can talk about how that actually might play out. Some of it's going to be, and I think this is going to be one of the most useful things early on for personalizing, helping with pharmacogenomics. Those variants that might alter the dose that you need of a medication because you might metabolize a drug differently, either more quickly or more slowly, or predicting an allergic reaction to a drug. So this sorts of pharmacogenomics is a really practical application of genetics that's got real life consequences to help avoid adverse drug reactions and to help maximize the benefit from therapeutics that I think we're going to see. It's already built in some healthcare systems already. So I think we're going to see that come in as a low-hanging fruit relatively soon. But I also think we're going to start to see genetic testing coming in to help us know who would benefit from looking for those rare disorders. So if I could perhaps use a slightly different example to bone disease and to think about diabetes for a minute. I'm an endocrinologist. I do diabetes as well as other endocrine disorders as well as bone. Both type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes are heritable disorders. They've got different genes contributing to developing each of those diseases. But when you have a person who turns up with hyperglycemia, say it's a young person at the age of, say, 25, do you know that they've got type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, or could they actually be maturity onset diabetes in the young, a condition called MODY? Now, in the immediate care, one immediately needs to look after somebody from a life-saving perspective. And for many people, that will mean insulin, at least in the short term. But for some of those people, knowing who to test for MODY, you can predict that by looking to see whether they've got a high polygenic risk score for type 1 diabetes or a high polygenic risk score for type 2 diabetes. If they look genetically that they don't have type 1 or type 2, then you might go and have a look for MODY or some of these other monogenic disorders. So you can use things like polygenic risk scores to categorize who you would think might benefit the most for looking for rare diseases. Now, to a certain extent, this conversation may well become obsolete within the near future, because at the moment, genotyping is a cheaper technology than sequencing. That's probably not going to be true within about 2 to 3 years. It's going to become the price of sequencing has dropped so dramatically that although we might gain the information about those little individual variants that I talked about beforehand, we might gain that information from sequencing to make a whole data set that we analyze. It's going to be done through sequencing. If it's done through sequencing, we'll have the information on the rare variants as well as having the information on the common variants at the same time. Now, that's not true today in 2025 in terms of costs and how things will work at the moment where people are doing this. It's generally in a research story, and generally for financial reasons, people will do the genotyping first and then look for the sequencing. But within certainly within the very near future, that cost differential is going to change. And therefore, you'll actually end up with both sets of information at the same time. You won't have to make a choice.
There's so much you've said there. You could pick up on one thing that stands out for me. You talked about the pharmacogenetics and how, you know, at the moment, everyone gets the same dose of hyaluronic acid for the same length of time. Everyone gets 20 micrograms of teriparatide every 24 hours for 24 months. We know people must respond differently to those things. Mm-hmm. And the idea that in the future, we would say, let's do a gene test and tell you which drug you're going to respond best to, and indeed tell you exactly which dose and for how long you should be on that drug for. Would it be too much to ask, if considering the five or six drugs we use commonly, which do you think that a genetic test might be most useful for? Would it be one of the osteoanabolic agents, do you think? You know, there are people probably would benefit from taking, let's say, teriparatide for longer than 24 months. There may be people who the anabolic window has probably closed after 18 months. Is it one of those drugs, or is it a response, let's say, to bisphosphonate, something much more common?
So I'm going to come back to the question and say it really depends whether the drug response to those particular drugs is heritable or is not. And of course, if something isn't heritable, I'm going to couch my answer with a little bit of taking a few steps back. I don't think we know yet whether allergic reactions to bisphosphonates, and some people do get adverse reactions to bisphosphonates. I'm not talking about first phase reactions, which are extremely common. I'm talking about rare reactions like the uveitis and iritis and a few of those, you know, those more unusual reactions. At this point in time, I certainly recently checked the CPIC, which is the Clinical Pharmacogenomics International Consortium webpage, very user-friendly, if any of the listeners want to go and have a look at it. I recently looked at that, and at that point in the story, there were no suggestions at this point in time that pharmacogenomics was pertinent to bisphosphonates. At this point in time, that doesn't mean that that will be the case down the track, but certainly at this point in time, that's where we are. To come to the comment about teriparatide, people have done GWAS looking at drug reactions. I can't at this particular point in time point you to anything that stands out to me from those particularly. But I would say, I'm just going to talk about teriparatide in mice, because certainly one of our colleagues, a lady by the name of Cheryl Ackert-Bicknell, has looked at exactly this question, to look at whether genetic differences in all the different mouse strains that it's possible to consider this in, do you get differential responses to teriparatide according to the genetic background of the mouse? And the answer is absolutely yes. You can actually, you know, across multiple species of mouse, you who've got all of these different types of genetic background, you can see a graduation of responses to teriparatide. So in answer to your question, is it likely that somebody's genetic differences are going to make a difference to anabolic agents? Certainly for teriparatide. And I believe somebody has actually also done a GWAS looking at PTH responses, though again, I don't have the results privy in my head at the moment. So I don't want to misquote anybody there. But if I could say from a mouse perspective, if you're a mouse, your ability to respond to teriparatide is determined by your genetic background. And if that's true for mice, it's likely to be true for humans as well. If you're looking for subtle differences, you need to be looking at a much bigger data set to be able to see those type of subtle differences. If you're looking for something which is much more extreme, like an allergic reaction, that might be easier for us to be able to detect and then predict than something that if you're looking at a difference between a 5% reaction, that it's going to take a lot more people before you see. And you might say that 5% differences isn't going to be worth exploiting it that way. And I think that's probably true. But if you see a 50% difference, then that would be something that would be easier for us to detect if it's a heritable issue. I mean, of course, the biggest, and I know that, David, I know you are a practicing clinician as well. The biggest reason that people don't respond to drugs is because they don't like taking them. Often a lot of our drugs, people don't like taking them because they don't like fear. A lot of people find that they can get refluxy symptoms. They don't like first phase reactions. They don't like injecting anabolics. And, you know, I really do understand that, that taking drugs is hard. And I think that's one of the things I'd like to think there is still space in osteoporosis genetics to think about new pathways to help us develop new drugs that people might find easier to take, that don't involve infusions or injections, or don't have the side effects that we know that many people experience with the bisphosphonates. So I know I'm moving the conversation slightly to one side, but I think our ability to think about using genetics to highlight therapeutic pathways, either for new drug development or for repositioning existing drugs, is another benefit from continuing doing research in common diseases such as osteoporosis, but also doing research in rare diseases, because the pathways that are illustrated when we work with people who've got rare diseases can be very relevant to people who've got common diseases as well. And you would know, David, and Richie, you know, romosozumab, this pathway was brought to light by looking at individuals and working with families who had sclerosteosis and Verrucano's disease, which is a high bone mass disorder. And by understanding that pathway in these people, it became obvious that this was a druggable pathway that we could use. And I mean, this is the pin-up story about how genetics has shaped therapeutics. It's a great story for the world, really, for how genetics can help things. And it's not, obviously, this is a bone podcast, which is why I'm talking about it, but it's not the only example by many means.
It's a really wonderful story. We've had some guests on before to talk about it from the company that made romosozumab, and we heard about the history of development. And listeners, if you haven't heard that episode already, go back and listen to it. It's absolutely fantastic. It's interesting to hear about how genetic testing might be useful for not only improving existing treatments, but also potentially identifying pathways for new treatments. One thing we were wondering about is gene editing. We hear a lot in the news lately about how companies are trying to develop new therapies like gene editing. Is it possible that we might see gene editing ever replace the more traditional medicines like bisphosphonates or even the anabolics?
I would split that by saying I think that we will see the evolution. We are already seeing gene editing technologies and RNA technologies coming in to treat particularly monogenic disorders and rare disorders. I think many people would be aware, for example, that I think it was November 2023, that was when the trials were first done with respect to some of the high cholesterol disorders. And many people would be aware that some of the drugs that we have, that was a gene editing trial, but many people are aware that we already have RNA treatments for hypercholesterolemia. I want to move the conversation back to bone and to say where I've seen the most exciting things have been looking at rare bone disorders. So there's, I think over a decade ago, there was a paper that was looking at the capacity to silence one allele. So we've got two copies of every gene. And often for osteogenesis imperfecta, one of the genes for CoAN alpha 1 or CoAN alpha 2, which are the two main genes that code for collagen in bone, one of these, one of the copies, carries a variant that's damaging. And this was a study looking in mice, again, and it showed that you could selectively take out the allele that was damaging and leave the other one, the wild type one, to get on with its effects. This still would mean that you would only have half the coding for collagen because you'd taken the other one out. But for many people who've got really severe osteogenesis imperfecta, the allele that's got the damaging variant doesn't just make a bad molecule itself. That molecule interferes with the function of the protein that's coming from the allele that isn't carrying the mutation. And so you end up with this double whammy. One has the variant in it and it makes an abnormal protein, but that abnormal protein also interferes with what gets coded from the wild type. So for this project, which was looking, could you selectively take the pathological variant out and just allow the wild type to express, showed that this was possible in mice. And that way you could take somebody who has a really severe form of osteogenesis imperfecta and perhaps make things milder. It wouldn't cure OI, but it would make it mild. That was about 10 years ago, and that at this point has not translated into humans. But one of the stories that I saw at the ASBMR at the back end of 2023 was the most extraordinary study. Again, this was done in mice, and in this case, it was a study in a disease called fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, or FOP. Now, FOP is a really horrendous disease where people have got a variant in one of the signaling, the bone morphogenic protein signaling pathways. And this results in any inflammation, including things from knocks and bumps and teeth coming out, they form bone. And so when the children are born, they've just got a slightly knocked, that their toe is slightly bent. But as they go through childhood, they gradually accrue more and more bone. And this ultimately leads to problems because their jaws fuse and they can't take a deep breath because their chest is encased with bone. It's a very, very severe disease. While I was on maternity leave, the variant that actually caused this was identified. My husband was in tears when the first drug treatment for FOP was approved by the FDA. Just such a wonderful story, because once the gene had been determined, the protein could be crystallized, a pathway, people could design drugs, they could understand what was going on, they could develop a mouse model, they could try different drugs. And now, although there's one drug which is licensed, there's a lot of other drugs which are in trial. And this terrible disease now has hope for the future. So that isn't gene editing, but it's just showing the power of doing genetic dissection of monogenic of rare bone diseases. But the story that I wanted to tell in answer to your question was that I went to this talk at the ASBMR in October 2023, and they were talking about these things called antisense oligonucleotide gapmers. I had no idea what a gapmer was. I had to go look it up on ChatGPT. And so what ChatGPT told me was that this was a particular type of small interfering RNA, and the fact that they're gapmers just has to do with making it more stable and being able to bind down. And what they were able to do was that they targeted the FOP mutation in a mouse, and they demonstrated that in their mice who had FOP, they could use interfering RNA to take out this mutation's function. So this is an activating mutation, and they took out the activating mutation in the mouse. Now, if that is true for FOP, that we can use small interfering RNA molecules for a gain of function mutation, then that's likely to be true for many other gain of function disorders. So it won't work for a loss of function, because in a loss of function, by definition, you've got a loss of function. So taking out it, the gene's not going to help you. But for gain of function, a priori, there is no particular reason why this should be unique to FOP. So there's a long way to go between a study that's done in a mouse model to getting this safely into clinic for human beings. And something has to be both safe and effective. But it really shows how wonderful the opportunities are to use our understanding of DNA technologies to start to deliver therapeutics in a life-saving sense for individuals. So to come back to your question about common or garden osteoporosis, I suspect not, because as I said, most the determination of bone density generally in the population is the cumulative effects of multiple variants, each of small effect. So I don't think that that's going to be, I don't think gene targeting and gene therapies in that sense is necessarily going to be effective in the way that it would be for a monogenic disorder.
Would it be possible to change the way the body responded to some of the common treatments that we use, even if you can't alter the 20 or 30 or 40 genes that contribute to osteoporosis? Could you make a patient more susceptible to inhibiting sclerostin, or more susceptible to the effects of denosumab, for example, which may be just editing a single gene?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say, David, is just to contextualise your question, that actually the number of variants that we know that determine bone density in the population is well over 1,000. So just to say that this is, and that's at genome-wide significance. So you know, there's lots and lots of variants that we'd have to do in terms of how you'd respond to the medication. I'd come back to my question about pharmacotherapeutics, and I wonder, you know, whether there's ways in which that we could adjust our dose or our duration of medications rather than necessarily changing the way the body responds. So I see in the short term that being the easier target to think about how we respond to medicines and then change our dosing accordingly, rather than necessarily changing how we respond to the medicines from a physiological perspective. But I'm going to give that some thought. That's my on the fly answer. But I'd have to think about it a bit more.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's a very honest answer. You know, I think like many practicing clinicians, we're always conscious that, you know, if you have hypertension, you adjust the dose of drugs up and down. If you have, you know, high cholesterol, you adjust, whereas we just tend to use the same dose, same drugs for every patient we see. And, you know, imagine we could do better than that.
I think, you know, with time, we will be able to become more sophisticated. And I should say, I just want to check myself to say that I said well over 1,000, and it's probably well and truly well over that in terms of the number of SNPs that determine bone density. But I can't tell you quite how many yet because it's currently under embargo. But you can all find out about this in due course.
I'll get Richie to go back and edit in that I said it was over 1,000.
That sounds like a very reasonable decision to me.
Listeners, you heard it here first. The NHS has got very large projects like the Genome Initiative, and they're going to sequence over 500,000 people. Will that kind of data allow us to understand much more about the number of variants and how those variants affect bone density, and potentially how gene editing or gene therapy or knowledge about somebody's genetics might improve our bone health in the future?
I think the answer to that is yes. I think these large data sets are incredibly valuable at giving us multiple insights for multiple conditions. And I would reflect on the success of the UK Biobank and how astonishingly fruitful that database has been for world science for a whole host of disorders, not just bone. And certainly the generosity of the UK Biobank, and by that I mean also the participants and volunteers who so graciously shared their data for the benefit of world science.
You mentioned privacy there. I guess with this large-scale genetic testing, there could be ethical dilemmas, you know, such as family implications or even just the privacy risk of having such a huge amount of data about people. Mm. Are there any things that doctors, patients, and our community as a whole should consider now as we go forward and we think about how we can use this genetic data to get the best outcomes for people?
I think the issue that you are speaking about isn't unique just to genetic data. So there are some things which are unique to genetic data and familial relationships, and being able to make inferences about relatives as a consequence is an example of that. But there's many other components of our data which we might not want to make public, including your address, your hospital number, which drugs you're taking, you know, the results of your last HIV test, the fact that you're having an HIV test. You know, there's a whole host of information that people wish to, that medical information that people rightfully would not wish to see splashed about on the internet. I think that data privacy is a core concern for everyone who works with human data, whether that data is genetic data or whether it's not. And then I think there's additional issues relating to genetic information that are on top of that general comment about the importance of privacy and making sure that we safeguard the information with very robust and appropriate due diligence to look after it. The first thing I'd say is that although I do think there are some unique things about genetic data, I think that data generally, it's very important that we recognise, respect and uphold our integrity of our of privacy. To come back to the question about specifically with respect to genetic information, certainly from a clinical perspective, one of the things that clinical geneticists within secondary care work with is with families and thinking about, you know, making sure that they look after those many of those ethical concerns and considerations. That's going to be more pertinent perhaps for rare disorders than when we're talking about common disorders. When we're talking about common variants, and as we said, you know, many, many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of variants that are relevant. So I think that there are important ethical considerations generally about data. There are some which are specific to genetics. I think generally speaking, the two big issues are monogenic disorders and cascade screening and paternity. But people are well and truly, these are not new issues. You know, these are not new issues, and people have been working with them for decades.
Yeah, I feel there's a general discourse in the public domain now about data protection in all sorts of fields. Bank details, etc.
Oh, absolutely. Your telephone number. Discovering that you've got a delivery coming and being scammed. Your information has, somebody's accessed the courier information and so forth. I think we're all very mindful about the importance of data protection.
Yeah, even at a clinical level, I mean, I see a number of family groups with osteogenesis imperfecta, for example, and people will turn up and you know, naturally say, you're seeing my daughter next week, or my husband's new drug is causing him side effects or things like that. And, you know, in theory, of course, everyone's a completely separate individual person, but in practice, you know, people do go home and talk about their drugs and talk about their appointments, and there's all sorts of sort of ethical issues around that, which we get around in various practical ways. You know,
I agree with you, and being able to say exactly as you said, really, and then not, you're being completely deadpan about not talking about somebody else in the family. It's a skill that you have to learn, where you just don't go down a pathway of discussing another family member in you know, and saying, I will look forward to talking to your husband in due course, but today I'm going to focus on you. Or I'll look forward to meeting your sister in due course, but today we're going to focus on you, in a way that very politely says, I'm not going to talk about this with you because I don't have permission to talk about this with you. And being able to very carefully bring the conversation to close off discussion about relatives' health. I know that clinical geneticists are in a slightly different circumstance, but certainly for me as a jobbing endocrinologist, and obviously for you too, David, it's being able to be very discreet when you're talking with families is very important.
Hopefully we've got time for one more question. Emma, your career is just amazing. You work across the globe in different continents, elected president of the ASBMR, which, although it's American, is really a worldwide institution. You do clinical care of your patients, and you do research, and you lead in both of those fields. I've seen you recently present at a conference on the scientific end. David saw you present at one on the clinical end. And in both of those, I saw how you advocating for your patients, advocating for scientists. And I know that you have roles mentoring other people, both in the clinical and research side. That's a lot. How do you sustain that level of drive? What keeps you going?
So, I mean, the first thing, I mean, I could give you a very practical answer, which is making sure I eat healthily and get enough exercise. But I'm going to, I'm and obviously the love of my family. I want to give you a slightly higher level answer than that. I think we have a responsibility to use the gifts that we've been given to help better the world. And I feel this very much. I was listening to a podcast earlier today, which was talking about education of women in Afghanistan, and that when the Taliban came in, girls were over the age of 12 no longer allowed to go to school. Well, I grew up in a country that believed in educating women and gave me equal access to go to university. And I am immensely grateful to the women who fought the battle for me 100 years ago to make sure I got the vote, and the women who fought the battle to make sure that degrees at university that women had earned were actually given to them 80 or so years ago. You know, it really is shocking to think how recently those privileges were extended to me, or not to me, but to women in general. So, you know, when my mother went to work in the 70s, she was in the 60s initially, and then in the 70s, it was up until the 70s where the Equal Pay Act came in, she was paid less than her male colleague for doing exactly the same job. So, you know, I think I have a responsibility to use the opportunities that those women who, you know, in some cases died for the cause, for in thinking about the suffragettes in particular, I have a responsibility to use the opportunities that I have been given by others' struggle to help further others. I really feel that, and I'm blessed in that way. I'm also very mindful that I'm having this conversation as a white woman, and that there are many women who not only have to face sexism, but also have to face racism as well. I'm also mindful that I come from a developed world, and there are many people in the developing world who haven't had the resources that I've been gifted as well. So I feel that when we're in a situation where we can do good, or, well, I don't know whether it's good or not, but where one can, when one's been given resources and opportunity, it is my hope that the efforts that I make will help others to be able to have a slightly easier path, and that this will be of benefit to other individuals in 10, 20, 30 years down the track. That's a very earnest answer, but it's what I think.
Yeah, no, that's what we're hoping for, a sort of earnest answer. I appreciate your candor in that answer. I think it'll be inspiring to many people listening, because we do have listeners, believe it or not, Emma, from right around the world, in both
developed
world and developing world. So I think it's an inspirational answer.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed speaking to you, and I've learned a lot.
It's a real pleasure. And I really look forward to, I really look forward to listening to more of your podcasts. I just love them.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. You're very kind. And we have to say, we didn't pay you to say any of those things.
You can buy me a drink at the bar next time, David.
No, we do very much appreciate your time and your extremely sort of educated and thorough answers to all those things, and your sort of honesty about it all. It's been very interesting and entertaining having you on the podcast. So thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
So, Richie, that was a very interesting chat with Emma. So much crammed into so little time. You sort of feel we could have doubled the length of the podcast almost, and Emma would still be keeping us entertained. What were your big takeaways then?
My first takeaway is I thought Emma was an excellent guest. We managed to cover a lot, as you say, in a short amount of time. Emma's got a really interesting perspective on genetics. As a working clinician and researching geneticist, she was probably the best person to talk to about this. I really enjoyed her explanations and descriptions. My key takeaway is that genetic testing isn't quite there yet for osteoporosis, but perhaps in the near future it will be. Emma spoke about how there will be some next generation genetic sequencing that will arrive in the next 2 or 3 years that would maybe allow us to genotype people properly. And as we were talking right back at the beginning of the show, there are hundreds of genes that contribute to osteoporosis. Maybe it would be possible to start putting all of the information about those genes together and computing some risk factor for the disease. But again, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, perhaps the most likely avenue for the use of this genetic data could be in predicting which patients are going to respond to which treatments. Who's going to best respond to an anti-resorptive or an anabolic agent or a bone-forming agent? Maybe it would even be possible to think about the sequencing of therapy. You know, what's the right sequence of therapy? And also, what are the right co-treatments? Anything that a doctor and a patient can do together to narrow down the right treatment and the right treatment protocol is going to help doctors to prescribe and patients to take with confidence. And hopefully that would improve the uptake of treatment.
It's all about having the data to have the conversation better, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess the other thing is that once there are very large data sets available that people can start to mine, genetic data sets alongside clinical data set with clinical outcome measures like bone mineral density, fracture risk, response to treatment, it will be possible to mine that data and then start to come up with predictive tools for people's fracture risk and their response to treatment. And that would be absolutely phenomenal. What were your takeaways, David?
Well, I suppose I had the novelty of, because as you know, Richie, I'm often accused on the podcast and at conferences of being told I'm allowed to ask one question, and I ask two or three or four. So I had the novelty this time around of asking one question and Emma giving us two or three or four answers. So I feel that was some redress for my behaviour in the past. But no, serious, very, very interesting. The things that I think about, for years we have talked about, you know, at meeting other doctors, I wonder how much osteogenesis imperfecta is out there that we're not picking up and just calling it, bad osteoporosis. And Emma mentioned the study that we've covered in Australia and the UK, I think, which suggested somewhere up to 4% of patients who were just believed to have, you know, common or garden osteoporosis actually had gene changes associated with osteogenesis imperfecta. And that's fascinating because it suggests maybe 1 in 25 of my osteoporosis patients doesn't really have osteoporosis but has OI. And indeed, you know, if it's that common, then there's a fair chance that two patients in that scenario, could be the parents of someone who may have very significant osteoporosis. And we do see people from time to time with extremely low bone mineral density, with fractures, and we do all the testing, you know, bar the genetic testing, and there's no obvious reason. And it may be that, you know, there's more osteogenesis imperfecta out there than we think of, and that will certainly something that I will sort of dwell upon in future. You touched on it as well, the idea of genetic testing, not so much to determine why the patient in front of me has got osteoporosis, but on helping us decide what the best treatment might be. And that's, you know, that's an interesting area. It's an area in which there's a lot of exciting avenues to be explored. And indeed, I can't remember if it was you or I asked the question about sort of treatment, you know, gene editing and that sort of thing, and how it's very unlikely we could edit one or two genes and change the diagnosis of osteoporosis, suddenly increase someone's bone density when they're in their 50s or 60s or 70s. But the idea that you could maybe alter one or two genes or edit one or two genes and dramatically change their susceptibility to a drug, for example, that's quite an interesting and exciting area, because ultimately at the clinic, that's what it's all about. It's about, yeah, we're interested in what's happened up to the last fracture or up to the last DEXA scan, but it's really the future that we're thinking about. And it's, you know, it's which drug, which exercise regime, which form of nutrition is best for the patient in front of me. And in the exciting world of gene editing, which we hear a little more about all the time, you know, the idea that we could make a drug work better by doing that would be quite exciting. So, yeah, lots of interesting things to think about. And again, as we say with many guests, it would be great to hear Emma. It'd be great to hear her again in a few years' time to follow up on these things.
It will be. I'm excited to do a follow-up, actually, and find out where all this goes. It feels like we could be on the cusp of something really big.
Yeah, it's an exciting time.
Well, thank you for joining us today, listeners. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye now.